And smartphone users, beware, the end of unlimited data plans is drawing near. Starting today, the biggest wireless carrier in the U.S., Verizon, will stop offering unlimited data plans to new customers. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports.
Paul Reynolds is the electronics editor at Consumer Reports, and he says if you're a smartphone user who's
playing games, streaming a lot of videos, shooting videos, and uploading them,
just using lots of data, and I'm talking gigabytes, then get ready to pay for it. Yesterday, customers at Verizon Wireless stores could sign up for just one data plan, and they could use as much web data as they wanted on their smartphones for just $30. Starting today, though, new customers will have to choose from a menu of plans. The cheapest? $30 for 2 gigabytes a month. Verizon Wireless spokeswoman Brenda Rainey says customers who already have unlimited data plans shouldn't worry.
Existing customers will not be impacted by these changes at all.
But for new Verizon Wireless customers, Paul Reynolds says the unlimited data buffet is over.
Basically, what Verizon is doing, like other carriers, is going from an all-you-can-eat plan to plans that bill customers according to how much data they use.
Verizon Wireless says most of its current smartphone users use less than 2 gigabytes per month. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Across the country, more than 24 colleges and universities are converting the energy that athletes expend while using exercise equipment into energy, electricity. That power runs straight into a building's power grid. One of the schools, Drexel University in Philadelphia, where we've reached Ann Simmons, Director of Recreation there. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's an honor to be with you.
So how much electricity can, let's say, an elliptical trainer or a treadmill really generate?
It's capable of 50 watts of energy over a typical 30-minute workout, and it can hold a light bulb for 2.5 hours.
So if it's 3 a.m. and nobody's using the treadmill or the elliptical trainer, does everything go dark?
That's correct.
Really?
Well, in the one area that we have designated in our facility where we have the equipment set up, it's a company called ReRev that has done it for us here at Drexel, and they've retrofitted a number of our cardio elliptical machines to generate power in that area of the building.
Can the power be stored?
Yes.
So, in other words, some guy doesn't have to pedal a stationary bike to keep your lights on there at Drexel.
That's correct.
The students know they're doing this?
Actually, it was the students' idea. They came to the athletic department during the construction of the facility and had this idea. Drexel is a very entrepreneurial university, and we're open to the students' ideas, and they're the ones who take a lot of pride in it that it exists here.
Mr. Simmons, I must ask, is this just a gimmick?
I think there's definitely a part of this that's for awareness, to bring the awareness factor to people of what's possible, but it does work, and we do generate power and are able to store it, so they're, and it's proven.
Hmm. So even if the exact amount isn't impressive, you think it's kind of the wave of the future?
Absolutely. Picture if every piece of equipment we were using, we were harnessing that energy, from the rowing machines to the treadmills to the exercise bikes to 3,000 people a day exercise in our facility. And right now we're only harnessing the power of a small amount.
Is it saving money?
We're not seeing that type of savings right now. I think over time, if we increase the amount of energy that we're generating from the equipment, we could. I think primarily it's an awareness campaign.
You know, I know some people who go into a gym just to sit in the schwitz, as we call it, the steam bath. No way of harnessing that, is there?
No, not at this time. Maybe in the future.
Mr. Simmons, thanks very much, and good rowing to you, sir.
Okay, very good.
Dan Simmons is Director of Recreation at Drexel University in Philadelphia. This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Good morning. In both its triumphs and its disappointments, the space shuttle is the icon of the American space program. It's been that way for 30 years and will remain so for a few days more until the end of the final shuttle mission.
As that mission goes on, it's worth recalling how the shuttle became what it is. For better and for worse, it came together through a combination of engineering, cost-cutting, and politics. Jeffrey Hoffman, a former NASA astronaut, now at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, says the shuttle plans evolved.
The shuttle was designed to be a extremely versatile spacecraft, which it has been. It's designed so that it could carry satellites into orbit, so that it could conduct scientific experiments. I mean, it has a wide range of possibilities. In order to be able to do all those things, certain compromises had to be made.
I want to try to make a comparison here. When you say that they tried to design the shuttle to be versatile, it's almost as if you're telling me that the NASA engineers were told to design a car that is a sports car, but with the carrying capacity of an SUV and the incredible energy efficiency of a hybrid and can also drive for 500,000 miles. I mean, basically a lot of demands were made on the same design.
Absolutely. And the result is there were some unfortunate compromises which definitely affected crew safety. I mean, the fact that the shuttle was decreed from top down to be so safe that we didn't need a crew escape system, which all previous human spaceflight vehicles had had.
If you had it to do all over again, if you were the one who was going to define what the shuttle would be today, how would you define the mission differently?
Well, I think one of the things we've learned from the shuttle is that in the future, we don't need to put people on a flight whose primary purpose is to carry heavy cargo into space. And this was the decision that was made after the Challenger disaster when, you know, we could have launched those satellites on expendable rockets. So the original idea at the beginning of the shuttle was that expendable rockets would go away and the shuttle would do everything. And that included launching a lot of the very large military payloads. And that was really responsible for a lot of the design decisions. I mean, the fact that the shuttle is so large is because of that. If you look at the very original sketches that NASA had done for a space shuttle, it was much smaller. It had two little stubby wings on it, and that would have been much more of a people carrier. But that didn't meet the political and economic requirements of the time, and so we ended up with the shuttle that we have.
So one of the things you might do differently today is not try so hard.
Well, we would separate the functionality. We would have a people carrier, which I think is what we will end up with for whichever of the private companies end up being successful with their attempts to build orbital vehicles. And then we'll launch the cargo on essentially cargo-carrying rockets.
How old are you, Jeff Hoffman?
I'm 66.
Do you dream of going up one more time somehow?
Well, I'm not old enough like John Glenn to qualify on that.
You're not old enough yet. I like that. That's a nice approach.
If somebody offered me the flight, I'd go in a heartbeat. I mean, I didn't stop flying because I was tired of it. I love space flight. I hope that the private sector will develop space flight to the point where many more people will have access to the experience that I've been fortunate enough to have. I mean, the hope is that the private sector could actually maintain the infrastructure for low Earth orbit transportation, which NASA could then buy those services for their own astronauts and hopefully then have more resources to devote to deep space exploration, which is what I'd really like to see NASA doing rather than running a taxi service to low Earth orbit and back.
Jeff Hoffman, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
He's a former NASA astronaut.
Microsoft is embracing what might otherwise be considered outlaw behavior, at least with its popular motion sensor for Xbox called Kinect. Kinect lets you play games by moving your body, no controller needed. And since its release late last year, it has been extremely successful. But not only gamers are buying it. Computer engineers and hobbyists have hacked the Kinect to do all sorts of things. Browse the web with a nod of your head, turn music up with a flick of the wrist, and lots more. Alex Schmidt reports that at least for the Kinect, Microsoft says the more hacking, the better.
In a dark, crowded workspace in West Los Angeles, two men flailed their arms around in front of a white wall.
Stand straighter, arms further out.
The sensor of the Microsoft Kinect was pointed at them, but they couldn't get it to pick up their movements. They tried crouching down lower, lifting their heads higher, and finally, they've only just started playing with the machine and brainstorming the endless things they might be able to do with it. One of the techies says we'll have sensors like these in our homes, and they'll be able to tell family members if we fall down. Another suggests conducting virtual orchestras. Todd Kurt was pondering his own killer Kinect app.
It's very exciting. I think the sensor that's in the Kinect is an amazing piece of engineering, and it's kind of unheard of that we're able to get access to it at such a price point.
It used to be that to experiment with motion capture technology, you'd have to spend thousands of dollars. The Kinect costs $150 and gives tinkerers access to the motion capture research Microsoft has already done.
I have two wrenches here.
Mark Bolas is a director at the Institute for Creative Technologies at USC.
I remember getting this wrench with my father when I was 13 or 14 years old, and then with it, I could start working on my bicycle, and I got into motorcycles and all these things that I could build. The wrenches of today aren't physical. They're these software wrenches.
Giving developers the wrenches to the Kinect was a calculated decision by Microsoft. They could have encrypted the system, but decided not to. Shannon Loftus is studio head at a Microsoft group that developed the Kinect. They launched November of last year.
And in less than a week, KinectHacks.net was up, and everybody who had anything to do with Kinect in Microsoft was glued to that site every single day. And every single day, some new innovation got circulated, and everybody kind of dropped their jaws in amazement.
One of the hacks let people move a robot using their bodies. Another let you finger paint by waving your hands through the air. Loftus says, for Microsoft, opening the system up to everyone else's creativity makes good business sense.
Their customers will buy Kinects, and at the center of the whole revolution in the way that people are interacting with machines is a device that Microsoft owns.
Stacy Holmes considered buying one himself. He's in a wheelchair following spinal surgery.
The gems are going to light up, and just touch them in the order in which they light up.
At a USC clinic in Long Beach, he played a Kinect game for physical therapy, stretching his arms out to grab virtual gems inside a mineshaft.
It causes you to try things at a pace and a precision that you wouldn't otherwise try to do. And so that and the grandkids, yeah, I'd probably try this at home.
Microsoft's approach to the Kinect is part of a generational shift in the tech industry. Letting other people in to tinker with inner workings could become the default for big companies, rather than building old-fashioned walls for control. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic and encrypted online backup solutions for home and small business computers. Learn more at carbonite.com. This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Applying analog law to digital reality can be tricky. Take the case of Ramona Fricosu, a Colorado woman who's being prosecuted by the Justice Department for her alleged role in a mortgage scam. Fricosu had an encrypted laptop that was seized during a search of her bedroom. Federal prosecutors want her to decrypt it so they can see its contents. Her lawyer says that would violate her Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. The government says its request is like asking for the literal key to a literal safe that may well contain incriminating documents. Well, joining us is Declan McCullough, the chief political correspondent for CNET, who has written about this case. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. It's a pleasure.
And first, what, if anything, is the established law about encryption and password protections and the Fifth Amendment?
Well, this is what makes this case interesting and also important. There isn't any established law. A few lower courts have considered this in the past, but the facts have been different. We don't have appeals courts ruling on this. Certainly the Supreme Court has never even come close to considering it. So we have cases updating the Fourth Amendment or the First Amendment for the Internet in the digital age, but we've never addressed this one head on. So this is going to be very interesting.
Now, the language and imagery of computers is full of analogies and metaphors. Documents are saved in files. Files are locked. Doesn't the law of paper documents and real file cabinets offer some clear guidance here as to what you do with the digital stuff?
I think you're right. Whoever wins this case is going to be the side that presents the best, most compelling analogies. In common law systems like the U.S., when you don't have a clearly established precedent on a particular issue, you go and try to reason by way of analogy and metaphor. And in this case, if you have encrypted files, is that like a safe? You can be compelled, according to Supreme Court precedent, to turn over the key to a safe, but you can't be compelled to turn over the passphrase, or that is the combination to the safe. So what's it more similar to? And this is what courts will wrestle with.
My understanding is that what was once a blanket protection of, say, diaries from prosecutorial searches has been narrowed over the years, and your diary is about as private a communication as you can possibly ever write. It can be subpoenaed.
That's true. Like some other rights that were outlined in the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment in the drug war, for instance, the Fifth Amendment has also shrunk a little. And so I think you're going to see civil liberties groups becoming interested in this as a way to say, let's go no further. Let's refresh and revitalize the Fifth Amendment for computers and encryption and the Internet.
On the other hand, I gather the government argues in this case that if encryption is considered an automatic barrier to any police search because of the Fifth Amendment, then everyone from child pornographers to terrorists to embezzlers would just encrypt and they'd be home free.
That is their argument, and it's a reasonable argument looking at it from a prosecutor's perspective, because encryption is becoming more popular. It's becoming embedded in operating systems in a way we didn't see 10 years ago. Apple's OS X operating system has it built in. It's called File Vault. Microsoft has it built into newer versions of Windows. It's called BitLocker. And so if everyone turns this on by default, prosecutors are going to have a more difficult time.
Well, Declan McCullough, thanks a lot for talking with us about it.
You're quite welcome. Good to be here.
So Declan McCullough, chief political correspondent for CNET, speaking to us from Stanford, California.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we have the latest installment in our Flying High series. We're marking the end of the space shuttle era by speaking with some aerospace pioneers. Today, we speak with Ellen Ochoa. She was the first Latina to travel to space. But first, to matters of personal finance. It's growing season in much of the U.S., and as farmers tend to their crops over the summer, there's one place where it's always growing season. That place is Farmville. It's one of the most popular games on Facebook, and tens of millions of people play each month. Players plow virtual fields, plant virtual crops, and raise virtual livestock. And you can't run a pretend business without pretend money, right? In Farmville, players use Facebook credits, a form of virtual currency, to buy supplies. For many players, that's just part of the game, but it's also serious business. Recently, the Federal Trade Commission was asked by a consumer group to look at whether Facebook credits violate antitrust laws. And beyond the legal questions, some people are starting to worry that virtual currency warps a user's perception about money, leading to overspending and some other bad financial habits. So who better to ask about this than our money coach, personal finance expert Alvin Hall? He's with us once again from our bureau in New York. Hi, Alvin. Welcome back.
I'm glad to be back as a future farmer of America. When I was young.
Really?
Yes, I was.
But that was real. But you were really...
That's right.
What was your... Did you do livestock? What did you do?
We did livestock. We planted okra, tomatoes, corn. We had pigs. We had cows. We had fruit trees. It was a pretty big, substantial family farm we had.
So you did the whole thing. What do you make of this virtual currency trend? And apparently Facebook credits aren't the only virtual currency around, right?
No, there are other companies that are doing this. And it started out in the gaming world so that if you wanted to buy certain products or you wanted to speed up certain processes, you could actually acquire these virtual currencies and make it happen. And then a company called Bitcoins expanded this and decided that they would offer this service on an international basis. So they offered this internet currency that you could then do person-to-person transfers between. So it's a world that seems to be growing, but I'm not sure that it's not dangerous.
Well, talk to me a little bit about why you think it might be dangerous.
Well, I think that plastic credit cards started to remove people from the reality of money. So you use your credit card or your debit card, and money moves in and out of your account. Here you're playing a game with virtual money. And at first, it can be a very good learning tool to help people understand that you have to pay for some things and that the costs go up or go down over a period of time. But then, when you start to use this money in ways that encourage you to take greater and greater risk, it may be encouraging people to use actual money in that way because they're too detached from it.
And there's also crime in this realm, is there not? I understand
yes.
that there was a huge heist of Bitcoin currency.
Exactly. Bitcoin has an exchange business called Mt. Gox. And somebody actually broke into that and managed to pull out about $500,000 in valuable Bitcoins from that. So people think these sites are very secure, but hackers attack them because they see this money as having value. And what's interesting about that is that Bitcoins went from having a value of $17 to having a value of 1 cent after the hacking occurred.
But does this have any meaning in the real world?
I question whether it does. Bitcoins holds out that you can buy products with it. Mostly you can buy things in the gaming world with it, although there are a few websites that will let you use Bitcoins for that. And also, they will let you trade Bitcoins with other people. I think this virtual money is ultimately a little dangerous. First of all, what's really backing it? Is there a government backing it? Is there a bank backing it? Then, if people can do this person to person, what types of things can they pay for? Can they pay for illegal drugs, which, of course, every website talks about? Can they pay for pornography, LSD, all of that sort of stuff, in addition to real goods? So this person-to-person transfer, where there's no monitoring of it, does give people freedom and anonymity, but it can also encourage people toward criminal activity.
Well, but the alternate view of that is if the people, you know, just because actors may play criminals, that doesn't mean that they go out and rob banks, right?
Yes.
I mean, or even if they engage in certain conduct that wouldn't meet their own personal moral standards, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, they're committing adultery or doing whatever because they're acting. Why isn't this just the same? It's kind of democratizing acting in the same way that the, you know, the internet has kind of democratized other things like news gathering, that anybody can do it without really doing it. Is that so terrible?
I don't think it's terrible if there's a moral component driving it so that people will not start to use it for illegal means. But anytime you have a facility that will allow for the large transfer of money from one person to another directly, eventually somebody's mind will start to say, well, not only can I pay for that sweater that way, or not only can I pay for that car that way, but I can also acquire other things. So I think when you have these open systems, everything starts out being about democracy, but then gradually criminal elements will enter it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about virtual currency with our money coach, our personal finance expert, Alvin Hall. What do you recommend? You often think not just about the problem, but about the solution. Is there
Yes.
something that you could recommend here? I mean, this isn't the only realm where many people think the technology has outpaced the ethics.
Exactly. So
what do you think should happen here? And do you have some thoughts about how people should regulate their own participation in these kinds of activities if they enjoy them?
I do. I think that people should recognize that these games are merely social networking locations where you can get to know somebody. You may discover that farming interests you in some way. But remember, it's a game. And if this game starts to encourage you to take riskier and riskier behavior because you believe that there's going to be a big payout, understand that that mindset could lead you to start doing the same thing with your money. So monitor your behavior very carefully. Also, when you're talking to other people on these websites, be careful that you don't become subject to undue influence by somebody who says, let's try this method. This may work for you. All of those things could lead you down a path that you don't anticipate. Remember, these are games. They're fun. They can teach you the basics of how to handle money, but they may not translate seamlessly into the real world.
Alvin Hall is our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. He was kind enough to join us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Alvin, always so good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. I'm going to go and get my Future Farmer of America jacket out and see if it still fits.
I'm sure it does.